government has an, the recommendation also indicated that government has an appropriate policy as recommended, which we are now saying that we do have the appropriate policy. And the phased development approach that is identified in the informal settlement upgrading program is part of the what Human Rights Commission is indicating as partial formalization, which is our phase one of the informal settlement upgrading program. What does that phase one entail? It entails shack numbering, identification of the emergency services needs, establishing the community profile, requesting Home Affairs to intervene when immigrants are detected, and lastly, providing emergency intervention services such as temporary sanitation, high mass lighting, and arrangement to allow access for emergency vehicles. All these are contained in the phase one of the Department's Informal Settlement Upgrading Program, and it's in line with what the Human Rights Commission has recommended. The emergency vehicle access arrangement will require temporary relocation of some households, and this is specified through the emergency housing program provisions. That is, in most cases, when this program is implemented, you find that in the nature of informal settlements are such that the shacks are so densely packed, such that at times we require them to move some shacks so that people, emergency vehicles can go through. And it's also, this is also in line with the recommendation of the Human Rights Commission that says that at times in informal settlements, emergency vehicles, there's not enough space for emergency vehicles to come through. But those four settlements that have been identified for formalization, this does take place. The program itself provides for a holistic development orientation, and all the people that are living in those informal settlements are part of the upgrading process. They are consulted, they make certain decisions that are also outlined in the policies. So, and as the first point of call is that the program favors in-situ upgrading as opposed to moving people or relocating people outside of the settlement. Then also the recommendation also from Human Rights Commission talk about obstructive leadership that are sometimes found in informal settlements. Then the department has looked at that and is recommending that this should be addressed locally through municipality, ward councillors, and the community. And this is already part of the informal settlement upgrading program where local communities are consulted. So this is not outside of the recommendation. Now moving to recommendation two. The Human Rights Commission is recommending that the residents of informal settlements, the department needs to engage with residents of informal settlements and RDP settlements in order to, one, to engage, to raise awareness of existing policies, B, to obtain information about the challenges faced in this regard with a view to develop appropriate policies and manage the ownership, sale, and rental of shacks and RDP houses. Regarding this recommendation, there has been a number of programs that have been put in place on community participation and community consultation, which are the fundamentals of our current policies, that there is never going to be an informal upgrading program where communities are not consulted. So the recommendations of the Human Rights Commission recommendations are in line with exactly what is outlined in the policy. Also, as part of the upgrading process, all the people that are living there are recorded and their profiles are established. And you might find that in addition to this, municipalities also do research, number of research, where then they will find out what the needs of the people are that are living in those in this informal settlement. And so there is a number of needs analysis or needs profile of the people that are living in informal settlements. And the communities themselves are also tasked to manage their informal settlements especially when it comes to redevelopment, and that is from when the phase one of redevelopment starts until then they receive their houses. That's part of the policy outlines what the communities have to do. And this is also in line with the recommendations of the Human Rights Commission. Also, as part of the program, of the communication program of the department, households are informed of their rights. What are their rights as citizens of this country? What choices do they have? And what obligations also do they have as now part of a formalized structure? So all that is part of the program. It's part of our also communication strategy that informal segment dwellers are informed of all these things. And this also is one of the recommendations that is outlined in the Human Rights Commission report. Then when it comes to funding, department, since the start of the program 2004, has specifically located funding for additional capacity to ensure that proper community participation is achieved. As a result, in each and every project, about 3% of the funding in each and every project is allocated for additional capacity to facilitate community participation. The people that are living in the informal settlements are also informed then, or they are required to make informed decisions. For instance, issues like township layout, they have to agree to it. They have to agree to the design of the township. They have to understand the nature and the level of the services that they will receive and the type of housing solutions that is required. All that is part of the department's program, which is also part of the recommendations that are outlined in the Human Rights Commission. One of the challenges that we are faced with, which we cannot be able to manage as recommended in the document, is that it's not possible to prevent the sale and renting out of informal structures, especially including unformalized structures and formalized structures, which is what the recommendation of the Human Rights Commission is saying, that we need to ensure that we prevent sale and renting out of informal structures. And unfortunately, that is the part that, as the department, our policies do not address. The beneficiary communities are informed of the risk that is, however, while our policies do not allow this, the beneficiaries during our community facilitation and communication, they are also informed that if they allow influx of people into the redevelopment areas, what consequences would they have in terms of the services that they receive? The sale of formalized property is prohibited by law. That is, remember that people that have got houses, they are not allowed to sell them until 8 years has elapsed. However, we have found that in some cases this also is not adhered to by the community, despite the fact that we have all these programs that are informing them that once you receive your house, you don't sell it for at least 8 years. So how much more than when we come to informal structures? The recommendation 3 from the Human Rights Commission is saying that we need to adopt a management perspective on the issue of informal settlement and undocumented migration. The department's response regarding that is that we are in an era where people migrate, and there's a lot that has been said about urbanization, that this continent, especially Africa, is affected largely by urbanization, including South Africa. Therefore, the large movement of people we cannot control, and it's part of development of countries. So migration of households to urban areas and by and large into informal settlements, it does remain a challenge, because then we need to be able to respond appropriately. and provide the required shelter and services. However, government, through the department, has adopted a balanced development approach to ensure that the rural development needs are also addressed, so that you're not only developing urban areas, you're also developing rural areas. So that also is done so as to create jobs, especially in the rural areas and also in the urban areas. But as I indicated earlier, migration as by itself cannot be managed or controlled. In addition to that, in order for the department to also have a better understanding of informal settlement and what population, because of the high rate of migration that is there, what populations are there in the informal settlement, we have developed a housing atlas, which was also distributed to the members, and the housing atlas it documents all informal settlements in the country. And it does allow us to plan for, especially for formalization and the services, and therefore also have an understanding in addition to that of how large is the housing need out there. The atlas itself provides a national perspective on informal settlements, where they are located in relation to the development potential and which areas should be a prioritized. So that is also in line with the recommendations of the Human Rights Commission. We are also updating the atlas regularly, maybe on 3-year intervals. So the updating of the atlas, it provides us with data on growth patterns and migration trends into settlements. So in a way, it's somehow a way of managing the migration that is productive, that is not causing chaos and preventative. In terms of what the Human Rights Commission has recommended. Also, the Human Rights Commission spoke about emergent housing assistance program. We have an emergency housing assistance program that provides for the establishment of transitional areas with formal tents and interim services as a strategy to manage urbanization. That is especially in areas that has been identified as at-risk areas. We do have that program, that emergency housing program. However, I would like then to highlight that there are some challenges that the House should be aware of. Despite that all the recommendations of the Human Rights Commission we have addressed through our policies, the overwhelming magnitude of the problem is that we have between 1.2 and 2 million households that reside in informal settlements. And if you count then the number of people, you have in total about 8 million people. And also, we also know that annually there are about 3,000 households that are formulated. That's the rate at which households are disintegrating and new ones are formulated. We also should be aware of that many of these households also live in backyard shacks and are unfortunately not counted as part of the informal settlement inhabitants. And we also have to cater for them as part of the department's program. The major challenge that we have, despite the magnitude of the challenge, is that the required capacity to deliver at the scale that is required, and also we don't also have the funding nor the implementation capacity to deal with the challenge. It's a mammoth challenge that we need to be aware of. Also, the balanced development approach. I think I have indicated earlier on that the approval of this program in 2004. It came about through the research that has been done and the experiences that we had in the past 10 years from 1994 of dealing with the housing program. Hence then the recommendation at that time that we need to adopt a balanced approach into the development of informal settlements, which we have. And that is also in line with international best practice. It's also in line with what the Human Rights Commission is recommending. So major issue is that we prioritize high-risk areas. And also we align them with the housing priorities and the number of communities that are also living in need of shelter. We are also required to attend to the needs of the households that are requiring assistance to access affordable rental housing and the affordable credit link subsidies. And as part of prioritizing all these people that are in need, the house should also be aware that some of these priorities are also part of outcome 8, which is in the next 4 years, the requirement is that we need to improve about 400,000 informal settlement dwellers and also ensure that we are providing affordable rentals. So these are some of the challenges that we are confronted with. The upgrading projects are all community driven. And as you know that community participation is time consuming at times. And it's something that we are aware of, and it's something that we're dealing with, that sometimes development, it looks like it comes a little bit long. It takes a long time for development to happen because of the community-driven development that we have adopted. Also, we're also aware of that in some cases, informal settlements are not in acceptable locations. And as a result, not all of them can be formalized. And as a result, then we cannot be able to give all informal settlements a formal tenure simply because of the location they are in. And as a result, then if that cannot happen, it means then that we cannot then deal with issues of township establishment and town planning and so forth. However, the major solutions that we have is that informal settlement upgrading by and large require de-densification and sometimes resettlement. Although resettlement is not the first option. Institute upgrading is indicated as the first option, but at times it does happen that there is a need for de-densification and the need for resettlement. So that's one of the challenges that we are confronted with. And lastly, Madam Chair, we also want to emphasize that, as I think last time we also indicated that, and in the report, also the Human Rights Commission is acknowledging that they have not consulted with us. And all the information that we are giving you today, we would have given this information to the Human Rights Commission had they spoken to us before they presented the report. Human Rights Commission indicated to us that we need to develop policies. And fortunately, we do have the policies that is in line with their recommendations. And also, the implementation of this policy takes place at provincial and municipal level. We also want to indicate that the Human Rights Commission, had they also contacted us, they would have known, or we would have also tried to provide them information about how municipalities and provinces are implementing this policy. And therefore, if they would like to make recommendation on the enhancement of this policy, then we would have accepted that. And I think, Madam Chair, we hand that to you, and we also like to say that informal settlement upgrading program is a daunting task. It takes time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. But I think it is better withdraw it, because the Human Rights Commission does not report to you. It reports to Parliament. And whatever they have reported to the Parliament, they have done their homework. They were there on the ground. They are reporting what they observed on the ground. Talking with you is just to, it's your, in fact, it is important that you collaborate with each other. But it does not change their observations on the ground. So they have to report to Parliament what they have seen. So I think those formal interactions, yes, we encourage them. But it must not be a defensive matter coming before us to say, no, if they have spoken to us, we would have been informing them, advise them about what is going on. Informing them of what is going on, but on the ground it is not there. It's a different case. So I think as the portfolio committee, with this report, we are accepting this report today, because last time it was too academic and technical, but now I think you have made strides to make it simple. You have made strides, so I think for that one, I give you a mark for that one at least. But I'm going to, otherwise, I wanted to say something before the members of Parliament.
Thanks, Chair. We acknowledge that, and we also acknowledge the role that the Human Rights Commission is playing in terms of its mandate by the Constitution. The small challenge was that some of the policy directives and recommendations that were being made are within the context of what already exists, and it's a matter of giving it context. We wanted to assure the committee, because as you read anything around human settlement, it might lead to a message that says we don't have the policy prescripts that they are recommending, which was a bit of a challenge. So we are not necessarily putting a defense position. However, we are confirming that the recommendations that are being made by the Commission, indeed, human settlement does have policies that are dealing with all the issues that are recommended. So in other words, the implementation of their recommendations is something that exists. However, we do acknowledge that the challenges that they have established on the ground, they are continuously facing, and we are putting plans, as I've indicated before, to deal with the challenges that currently exist on the ground from a human settlement. But the policy perspective does exist. We wanted to assure the committee with that. Thanks.
That thank you very much, Chair. And also, I think the answers are very comprehensive, and I think they're assisting us to understand some of the issues. It's just a point that I wanted just to raise, that you know, whether the Human Rights Commission was given these answers on time. General, they didn't interact with you. Surely, of course, they've interacted with Parliament. I hope that you'll be able then to give the human rights all the answers. Because also they should be informed about some of the issues that they pick up, that we are taking them very seriously. Because they're one of the most important organs of supporting democracy. Therefore, we should respect them, we should do everything that is humanly possible to answer that. I think that interaction with these bodies, all of us, really, I think it's very important. Because we shouldn't do anything that undermines the operation. And then where they make mistakes, I guess we always interact with them. Of course, we are functionaries, we are daily involved in this problem. They may not really be dealing with housing only, they're dealing with the main other issues, you know, that I guess they are raising this matter. Because I think human settlement problems, they do cut across all other problems, you know, that they are. They can cause a lot of other harm in other areas. I think that's why they get involved in that, because the fact that these things also, human settlements, can also assist to address some of the problems. I think even those who are starting violence, I think they'll come to you anyway, surely, because some of the areas around the housing that also instigate people to do some of the issues that they're doing. I think even those who are starting xenophobic sentiment also, I think human settlements become a center. Therefore, we are a very important department, I guess, that deals with many some of these issues. Chair, the real problem that I said that the informal settlement are very difficult. But I just guess that there should be a systematic program of trying to upgrade informal settlement. And if you are around the major cities in our country, there may be also human settlement somewhere in rural areas for those who are forcefully evicted by the farmers in other areas. But generally, around the major cities, I think there is a formal informal settlement there that I think the department must be concentrating on them. Because sometimes they cause a lot of problems, and just as one person, if also we may have a situation like in Haiti in this time, the cholera epidemic, I think also our South Africans suffer terrible times. The men in which our formal informal settlement are doing it. And I guess that the point that was raised in one meeting of trying also to provide sites and services could also be part of our solution for some of the problems. It's a difficult thing, but I guess that it's one thing that should really be considered. But the one issue that I think was a general point that I wanted to raise, generally, Director General, is not relevant to this. It's something that worries me a lot. That I think we are not concentrating, I think all of us, that not just human settlement, but the entire government, or the department, of making our cities very vibrant cities. In fact, we do have very strange cities. At night, they sleep also. And I think in fact, even to come here at night, you know, it's very scary because it's a dead city. I'm not sure what can be done, Church, as true. I think I'm raising it broadly, Director General, really, not for answers to their no. It's just my worry that all the cities, generally in South Africa, at night also they go to sleep like us. They are not really very vibrant. I guess that human settlement should be able to inject life in these cities because they are very dead, in fact. They are just dead cities. Very scary to walk around these cities. During the day are very nice cities, but during the night they are almost dead. I think human settlement should try to revert, and then the whole issue of the people, residents, the people working in an area. And I guess that the human settlement really, at a broader level, they can assist us to make these cities a little bit vibrant. And I think as a result of that, they make it very difficult because there are a lot of resources that are put in these major cities. A lot of water, sewer system, sanitation is already there. But it seems you allow them just to go down, you know, instead of trying to make them vibrant or accommodate some of the problems, particularly around rental accommodation. It's a point that I wanted us to raise, really. Other issues I think we have covered, you have covered, we are raising this one. But that one really it worries me a lot. I think we shouldn't go for a 20th anniversary without having turned around some of the inner cities. Because I think they can assist us to accommodate a lot of people if we focus on them. Ensure that our cities at least remain the real cities like all other metros in the world, very vibrant, dynamic, economically viable. Some of them, because they go to sleep like us, I think the biggest problem is economic.
Thank you.
Thank
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I think the member is reading all my questions. But it's fine. Actually, mine is just to see if there is any plan of stopping people from selling their RDP houses. And then what measures do we have for those who want to upgrade themselves? Like I get an RDP house in a year and then I get a better job where it's going to pay me 15,000. Now, what plan do we have as the department to assist those people? And then the other issue is the issue of the atlas that you say you're having every 3 years that provides the growth of the migration. How much migration do we have since 2008 up until now? But anyway, you won't have that answer. But I just wanted to clarify this issue of some people are selling their RDP houses because they want to upgrade their standard of living. Now, do we have any measures where we can assist people like that? And then those who are selling RDP houses because of financial, is there any measure that you say, if you want to sell the house within 2 years, before that 8 years, the first person that you must approach is the government to see if you've got other means, maybe you want to pay rent or something, but we must have a knowledge that person won't go back and build a shack. Because if you find that most of these shacks, those people have already received RDP houses. And I don't understand, a person will get 3 RDP houses. Don't we have names in the database where we can find out before we can allocate a house to Mr. Figler that you had the RDP house in Eastern Cape? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, I agree with you that this time round we can accept the response. However, Chair, on paper it all looks very well. But I think we all know the implementation doesn't gel with what's on paper. Now, the very first question I'd like to ask is the response to recommendation 1. And the department refers there to a 2004 approved policy. Now, I know that since then the department has gone through a restructuring process at least twice. Are they telling us that they haven't re-looked at the 2004 policy and they haven't adopted or adapted that policy to address concerns as and when they've changed between 2004 and 2010? Then it also says that all 9 provinces have identified critical informal settlements, but Chair, we know from our oversight visit that we've done, very few provinces could provide us with information on what they deem to be their critical informal settlements. And in addition to that, there was very little going on in terms of the policy that you've got in the paper. The other thing that I want to address, and this comes from a personal experience fairly recently, I mean, again, response to recommendation 1, provide emergency interventions. Now, in Protea South, there's an informal settlement that took the metro to court in 2008. They actually have a judgment in their favor that the metro must provide them with basic sanitation, water. It's 2010. I've been there about 2 months ago. Nothing has been done, notwithstanding that there's actually a court judgment in that regard. And that's why I'm saying, Chairperson, on paper I can't fault it. Perhaps with the exception of, I wasn't aware that shacks were actually being sold and rented out as well. And I'm not sure how the department can handle that. That's a very informal thing. So with that exception, I'm not sure how, like I say, I can't fault the policy. The other thing that, and some of my colleagues have touched on it, community consultation, households are informed of their rights and choices. Again, when we get onto the ground and you talk to people there, they actually know very little. Now, some months ago in one of the presentations, we were told that, I don't know, some 40-odd million SMSs are sent out by the department on a regular basis, basically to everybody that's got a telephone number. I must admit, I haven't received anything from the department. Not that I'd want to, but I can't see how they differentiate. If they're going to send to 40 million odd telephone numbers, by default, I think some of us would have to get that as well. And I don't know if anybody that have told me that they've received an SMS message from the department informing them, giving them some sort of information. And then just lastly, Chairperson, I've noticed on the department's website a very informative newsletter, and they're on newsletter number 3. I'd like to ask any one of my colleagues here, if they're aware of that newsletter, if they've seen it, to put up their hand. Now, we also have a responsibility to inform our constituencies. But if we, in the first instance, are not aware of these things that the department is doing and the newsletters that they are putting out, then how, you know, how does those the communities out there, how do they get this information? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Look, I think everything has been said. It's been, thank you for bringing the presentation here. And I think, you know, just to confirm that this is not only what the Human Rights Commission has found, but it's what we actually have experienced and have gone on our oversight. And that's been, you know, the good thing about us getting out there as Parliament and the policies. And I think it's been very good for us to have this refreshed this morning that this actually does exist. But I think it also highlights the breakdown between the spheres of government working together for me, and intersectoral as well, because with your people, the whole xenophobic thing, Home Affairs has got to be very critically involved in that, and actually these things are not happening on the ground, and I know because I've worked in an informal settlement, and it just doesn't happen. You know, you can number shacks, but because it's not properly controlled and monitored, you know, others are coming, and a couple of years down the line, people don't even know what those numbers mean. So, you know, it's just not being properly monitored. I just want to perhaps ask and to follow on from what my colleague here has mentioned about the priorities. And I think we get back to what we've been saying over the last, I don't know how long now, that a list like that would assist us as a community if we had that priority list, so that we could do a meaningful follow-up, so that we're sure we're all working together towards the same thing. So, you know, I think it is all here, what the Human Rights Commission are requesting, but I think we do need to be implementing our policies and making sure that they are working on the ground. It means getting out there to go see that it's actually happening. I think that's part of our role as a committee when we get out there as well.
Thank you very much, Honourable Members. DG, I think you need to respond.
Thanks, Chair. The colleagues will also add more information. I think the critical aspect of a challenge revolves around implementation. Implementation. I think it's a general challenge that we've always spoken about in these meetings. And again, as I've already highlighted earlier on with my remarks, that the policies are in place and they are sound, and the biggest challenge is the implementation of the policies. I think that's where our strategies should be beginning to focus on. And some of the issues that have been highlighted by the Commission themselves are around the implementation on the ground. And our responsibility, unfortunately, at a national level, it's more around the development of sound policies. But when it comes to implementation, again, there comes a concurrent function, because the implementation is done by the provincial department in terms of ensuring that. But as the committee is aware that the targets are set in terms of the outcome aid, and agreements have been signed to implement the policies that have agreed, and that includes the upgrading of informal settlements. Targets have been set, and that's what we're implementing. So our focus right now, departmentally, is to ensure, Chairperson, that the targets were set in relation to the implementation of our informal settlements or upgrading of informal settlements. That's what we are now monitoring through the performance and management system that we have put in place, through the agreements that have been signed with the minister and the MECs. And the outcome aid is trying to say it sounded good on paper, as members are saying, but what is happening on the ground? The performance agreements that are being signed, the delivery agreements which are being signed by the minister and the MECs, are meant to try and achieve that. Same applies to the agreement that I have signed myself with the minister. It's also aiming at ensuring that we begin to monitor the targets that we have set for ourselves within those agreements. So for me, this is the crux of the matter insofar as this report, that on the ground, there is nothing that tangible is happening, particularly in the era of informal settlements, and that is included in our performance agreements, and that's what we're monitoring. Our teams are going out, as I've indicated as well. They are visiting provinces based on what we have on the paper. We're trying to establish what is actually happening on the ground insofar as this area is concerned.
No, I don't think that's enough. We're not going to break it. It's a mouthful what the DGS has raised. Because mostly those were the comments by the members. But I think the issue of what is lacking in this report, at least we have not even made a stride to mention one example of the area that you have attended to. I think it was important that you made examples of the areas, just a couple of the areas that you have attended to. And I think the issue of the policy review, although DG, you have mentioned it that for quite a long time, I think the housing act itself, it has to be looked at. But in our, I'm sure you have got to our recommendations at the portfolio committee, we need to have a review of all the legislations that we are having so that we address some gaps there. Because it is not enough to say the legislation that is regulating the selling of the RDP houses, it is there, but it has no impact. So it's not enough to say no, that there's nothing you can do. There's quite a lot of that you can do, and I think those delivery agreements we have signed with COPTA, that's where it comes in here. So you do have a mechanism that can drive this process. And then the other issue, the last thing, is the issue of the implementation. And you have even mentioned that you don't have the capacity. Yes, we understand. You cannot have everything. That is why there is this intergovernmental relations that has to be promoted. Because as a department, won't get the problem. But you have to work with other departments so that you succeed. So I think those delivery agreements are more especially the local government. And I think all the other issues are going to interact. How are we going to assist the department in making sure that at least you manage to deliver according to your mandate? As a portfolio committee, we are there to advise, we are there to guide, we are there to assist, so wherever it is necessary. So with those few ways, I think we can come to the end of this session. We are going to take this report to the speaker, because this report has been requested by the speaker of parliament. So I'm going to make sure that before we arrive, the report has been submitted to parliament. And then with our observations, and they are going to be tough, our observations, because we have to at least to ensure that although you have reported, but there are other issues that we have realized that there has to be a backup to improve the service delivery. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. We will accept the comments with your permission, because some of the comments that have been made by the members of Valid would like to add more quality on the submission if it will be going to the speaker before you submit the one that you have presented and put it in a much more proper format. If you allow us, we'd like to visit her. Thank you, Chair.
No, Chair, I don't want to debate anything. I've heard the DG say that they want to make additions to the report, and I would just like to request that we get a copy of that before it's tabled, because it's going to be tabled as a report from this committee, I presume.
It's just to beef up on the issues that have been raised. There's nothing new that should be coming out from the report in terms of the responses to the recommendations made by the Commission. Like the issue of examples, for example, that the Chair is referring to, we should then also reflect. Can I ask to be released, Chair, as well? Can I ask to be released as well? Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. I was actually looking for this one on the internet last night. Someone told me there was something in the world.
Honorable members, let's resume our proceedings. We are going to deal with the legislation now. and the state law advisors are here. Advocate Daddy is here. Professor is here. Mr. Giba is here. Mr. Mgomezulu is here. Everybody is here. So let's hope for the best. Can you lead us crazy on behalf of advocates? The process we're going to follow today is clause by clause, and then we debate it. We have got a parliament, the legal unit, they are going to make an input, everybody is going to make an input. And then we have got the research unit that is going to lead us in terms of our, in terms of the public submission, what we have observed. And then we can think of reaching the consensus in amending some clauses, or the committee is going to go back and review some other area. Thank you. Over to you, please.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, and to Honorable Member. Through you, to allow me to read this Community Scheme Ombuds Service Bill.
Okay. Chair, my apologies, but we've just been handed a communication by our research unit, which would, if we address this or and decide that we may include this, I imagine would have an impact on many of the clauses in the bill. And I'm just wondering if you've seen this communication, if we shouldn't deal with this first and decide whether it will be part of the bill or not. Because like I say, my argument is if we agree with it, it will fundamentally change a lot of clauses here, and we'll actually then have to go back to it again.
What I'm saying, we need to run through the public comments. We're going to get an information from the research unit. What the public is saying in relation to this. There are some easy issues that you can handle today, but we need to know what are those issues, so that when we debate those issues, when we are on our own now as a committee, because we are still going to discuss the legislation as without the department and make some amendments, so we are going to deal with those issues then. But we need to know what were the public comments? Because last time, I don't think we the way, the manner we did it, the public comments were not highlighted in this process. But for me, I think it is important that we highlight them here in this process, so that the department should know what are the issues, and then when we finalize the legislation, they should know where did we get those issues, how, and then the manner we have decided to deal with them. Are you happy now? So.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks to all the members. Through you, Chair, allow me to read, you know, to the South, the Community Schemes Ombuds Service Bill, Bill number B21 of 2010. A bill, as it says, is to provide for the establishment of the Community Schemes Ombuds Service, to provide for its mandate and functions, and to provide for a dispute resolution mechanism in community schemes, and to provide for matters connected therewith. Thank you, Chair. Then we'll deal with the arrangement of Act and the sections. The Act is divided into chapters. Chapter 1, Honorable Chair, deals with the interpretation and definition. Chapter 2, Honorable Chair, deals with the Community Schemes Ombuds Service. And therefore, it deals with the purpose of the Act. 3 deals with the establishment of service. 4 deals with functions of service. and then 6 deals with Board of Service, 7 appointment of members of board, 8 functions of board, 9 disqualification from membership of board, 10 resignation and removal from office, 11 fiduciary duty and disclosure, 12 committees, 13 delegation and assignment of functions by board, 14 appointment of chief ombuds and chief financial officer, 15 conditions of appointment of chief ombuds and chief financial officer, 16 removal of chief ombuds and chief of financial officer from office, 17 acting chief ombud and acting chief ombud and chief financial officer, 18 functions of chief ombud, 19 functions of chief financial officer, 20 delegation by chief ombud and chief financial officer, 21 staff of service, 22 funds of service, 23 application of public finance management act, 24 tabling parliament, and 25 delegations. Therefore, Chair, I'll 26 additional functions, 27 provisions of information, 28 intervention by minister, 29 regulations, 30 judicial management and liquidation, 31 security of information, 32 documents relating to litigation, 33 limitation of liability, 34 offenses and penalties, 35 independence of service, 36 practice directives, and 37 privileges, immunities, and non-waiver.
I would like to check on the members. Are we all happy about chapter 2? Another comment?
Yes, I'm quite happy with that. I just want to know where we're going to deal with the inserts, you know, that you've got here, which seems to come before that chapter.
It's still an introduction. They are still busy with the introduction. That is why I'm saying, are we happy? Because the introduction is dealing with the sections or chapters that are there within the legislation per se. So they are just reading that this legislation comprises of the sections or chapters.
Thank you, Chairperson. If you allow me, we'll propose that, given the fact that we have dealt with chapter 1 and 2, we think that it will also be prudent that you're not to deal with that particular chapter in terms of interpretation, and then I'll go to the other chapter to read it as it's outlined in terms of the text itself. But for now, I'll draw the attention of the members to page 4, which deals with chapter 1, interpretation. Page 4, that's chapter 1. Dealing with interpretation definition.
Before you go there, I think there is a submission by the public to say, suggesting that the bill must also look at the conduct of the management agents. So I think the research unit should read that submission.
Thank you, Chairperson. The National Association of Managing Agents, or NAMA, submitted the following. They emphasized the fact that managing agent industry should rather be regulated by the Ombudsman. The Ombuds Services Bill, and not the State Agents Affairs Board as it's currently the case. And they suggested further that should this suggestion be approved, the current code of conduct of NAMA should be included into the new bill. This code of conduct was approved by the State Agency Affairs Board and related to the Department of Trade and Industry for their approval as well. If one, I'm referring to the documentation I just handed out to members, if one looked at the submissions that were also submitted to the department subsequent to the publication of the bill, there were a number of submissions that requested that managing agents should fall under the jurisdiction of the ombudsperson's bill. some of the arguments raised was that that managing agents have a long-term relationship with their clients consisting of a constant flow of transactions through a trust account, and this involves considerable interaction. Estate agents, on the other hand, have a short-term relationship with usually one transaction involved. Further, that the estate agency affairs board interprets its responsibility with regard to managing agents as pertaining to financial affairs only, while ignoring other complaints. Further, that the requirement to practice as a managing agent is in reality an estate agent qualification, which has little relevance for activities of managing agents. In addition, the code of conduct currently applicable to managing agents is directed at estate agents. NAMA, as I indicated before, proposed a code of conduct for managing agents in 2003, which, according to NAMA, has not been implemented by the Estate Agency Affairs Board. They therefore recommended, in a number of other submissions, recommended that the managing agent should be regulated by the Ombuds Service Board. I think the issue of the implications for the committee will deal with later, Chair. Thanks.
Thank you. I think this submission is not new in this house, more especially with the department, because we have picked up from the submissions that were sent to the department, and fortunately they also sent those submissions to the portfolio committee. So I think we can get the view of the department, because we have seen it. Can we get the view from the department?
Madam Chair, I believe that the view of the department on this is that the bill wasn't originally intended for this purpose, but and there may be some issues as between various departments, but this is not something that I think the department is allergic to in any way. There's no doubt that managing agents are an important part of the management hierarchy. It is estimated, although there are no hard figures, that about 40-50% of all schemes in South Africa do use the services of managing agents, and there is no doubt that conflicts between the managing agent and schemes are ones in which they are unequal bargains. So the a suggestion which might be that the managing agents are major service providers to all sectional title schemes, and most other forms of community schemes do have managing agents of some sort. These are not the only service providers, but they are the major service providers. A possibility the committee might like to think of is to allow the Ombud to settle the terms of codes of conduct, not necessarily in the bill, but perhaps to approve codes of conduct, and then to enforce those codes of conduct in the context of the orders which are given by adjudicators.
I think we're still going to consult even our legal advisors about it. And fortunately, the Parliament has granted us a study tour to learn about this experience. So we are going to look at it as a committee. But I don't know if members would like to comment on this one, because the managing agent is very crucial in this matter. So I think something has to be done. That is why, as the portfolio committee, we did not adopt the sectional title, because we knew that there may be other issues that can rise up from the side of the ombudsman. So, Honourable, I'll send on the hand from Honourable Richard and Honourable Faye.
Okay. I've never met the NAMA team. I just know that there are these management and sectional charges throughout the country. And then I guess that they used to fall under the Department of Trade and Industry at a certain point in time. But I do think that's logical. I think the argument that's presented by this team, I think logically, of course, we need more time ourselves to look at it. But really, I think logically, it should be able to be part and parcel of their own good services. I don't think there's a problem anyway to set all code of conduct for the people who are going to be using to manage anyway the sectional title. I think somewhere in the field ourselves, we must build up our mind, hopefully the department, even our team, just to work out some. We shouldn't have many fields and many management in many other fields except in one field. I think it's an idea that we should really look at it. In my view, really, I'm in favor of that. Of course, we need more scientific way of doing it, but generally I think it's the best way of ensuring that we manage the thing a bit tighter. Because they're very important, and also when I think is a very big very big service whenever to community. And in my view, I think we should really work on that one. But hopefully we'll be able to after we look at it, you apply our mind, we'll be able to engage with the department. But I think the section attacks the one, we should really try to locate this in our mind. That is a gut feeling, really, because I don't know how they are managing the issue. Because a lot of outstanding issues in some of these agencies that I think ourselves should be tight in some of the rules that regulate their conduct.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, I support, I think, what Richard said, if I understood him correctly. But what I want to emphasize is that I think in order to get the managing agents into the bill, we also need to look, as you've indicated, Chet, or to the previous bill. There's going to have to be some reference there in terms of the managing part, and then obviously in this particular bill in terms of the dispute resolution side. So I'm not sure if the department is going to come forward with some suggestions as to how this gets addressed in the previous bill, and our legal people is going to look at something as well. But I think it's going to affect the other bill as well.
No, I think we won't have a problem because we're working together. They can make a submission and then we can also work whether we consider their submission or we amend their submission. We know that the processes or the procedures. And then I think the state law advisor has got no problem on this one. Okay. Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. We are on page 4, chapter 1, dealing with interpretation and definition.
Yes, that page 4 is our page 7.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks for our member. We're on page 4, chapter 1, dealing with interpretation and definition. This is number 1, clause 1, Chair says, in this act, unless the context indicates otherwise, 1, the term adjudicator means an adjudicator as contemplated in section 21.3. And then 21.
Let's go to 21.
21.3. Honourable Chair. 21.3 says the board must, for each regional office, establish, appoint, and that would be A, an ombuds and a deputy ombuds with, but now with the one that is relevant to the definition is number B, a full-time and a part-time adjudicators with, Roman 1, suitable qualifications and experience necessary to adjudicate disputes under the supervision of an ombud and deputy ombud, and from figure 2, suitable qualifications and experience in community scheme governance.
Any comments? No, I do have. What is the definition? Can you help me? When you refer to a definition, what is the definition?
A definition in a piece of legislation is there to provide a meaning, you know, to a word or to a tender.
The meaning of the adjudicator in this text. Because here you are referring to the appointment of an adjudicator. What is the meaning of an adjudicator? Is that a definition? Because we do have legislation. For instance, the latest legislation, all the definitions, majority of them, those issues, those areas are being explained. What do you mean by that? And then your numbering, you say 21.3, instead of saying 21.3b.
Okay, you know, like I'm saying that it's like it's a drafting practice. Sometimes that you refer, and like for example, when you provided for under 21.3, it provides a clearer and a broader definition or a meaning to that particular term that you have used, rather than for us to redefine or take that particular provision as provided for under 21.3. To put it, under the definition. That's why we are referring to it, to say that an adjudicator means as contemplated under Section 21.3. And then 21.3b provides clearly in terms of, what is, this adjudicator and what is expected of this adjudicator to do. So normally it's...
Yeah, well, that's practice, that's because we've got legislation, I think, simplicity is legislation, because it's one of the issues of farmers council. What is an adjudicator? For instance, near and near only definitions are gone. We clear, but last set and dwelling, set and do, last set and financial institution, set and do, last set and household, set and do, last set and landlord, what is a lease? But after the person means in the fire for the short name, but it's all in the government of Balai. It's not here. But I'm not saying this is the issue we are adjudicator, but I'm referring to this as one of them. We'll see as we go down. The shorthand, I used to stand out. Because the legislation I used to fund, around on the ground. I'm just undoing a button,
my observation generally in the legislation is that a definition really may not necessarily mean a general definition of a particular word, but it is a definition according to the legislation. In other words, adjudicator here would understand it according to what the legislation calls an adjudicator. Because we're going to find the same trend, for instance,
they say down here chief financial officer. Now you are expecting a definition that is going to define what a chief financial officer is, but it doesn't say so. It just says it is the chief financial officer appointed in terms of. So all the time you have got to keep on referring to the legislation as to, in this particular legislation, what is a chief financial officer. You might find that in another legislation it might mean something else. In another legislation it might mean something else. I don't know, but this is how I understand it, or I have observed, you know, with the legislation generally. For instance, if I want to know what adjudicator is, I still have to go to a dictionary and check in the dictionary what adjudicator is. But the legislation do not necessarily give a definition as, for instance, a dictionary would. They give a definition according to how they use that particular structure or word or person.
I understand you, ma'am, but I still...
I understand your point, but I'm just saying generally, this is how the legislation is written. But I understand your point. For instance, myself, now if I want to know what generally an adjudicator does, I will go to my office and check in my dictionary, because this is not telling me what an adjudicator is, but this is just telling me what the adjudicator is according to this legislation.
Thank you, Chair. Number two, definition is association means any structure that is responsible for the administration of a community scheme. Board means the board of service established by Section 6. Chief financial officer means the chief financial officer appointed in terms of Section 14. Chief ombud means the chief ombud appointed in terms of Section 14. Common area means any part of land or building in a community scheme which is intended for common use by occupiers. Community scheme means any scheme or arrangement in terms of which there is shared use of and responsibility for parts of land and buildings, including but not limited to a sectional titles development scheme, a shared block company, a home or property owners association, however constituted, established to administer a property development and a housing scheme for retired persons, and honorable care scheme has the same meaning. Department means the national department responsible for human settlement. Director General means the Director General of the national department, whatever will ensure that we correct the definition so that, you know, they be consistent.
From the previous
situation.
Yes,
from the previous.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll align it with the previous one as suggested by the members.
Mm.
A dispute means a dispute in regard to the administration of a community scheme between persons who have a material interest in the scheme, of which one of the parties in the association, occupier or owner, acting individually or jointly.
Chairperson, in one of the submissions that was made by the Banking and Financial Services, they are querying whether, in fact, it should be only the owner or it should be, you know, occupier as well as owner, which an occupier would then be somebody who was renting the property. Now, was that dispute involved? anybody or specifically the owner. That is a query of the same way.
Yeah, no, I think the dispute, it accommodates all the people who are involved. It's either an occupier or, because there could be a dispute between a tenant and somebody else with those minor civil issues. So they have to be addressed by the concrete person. There will be various disputes that are coming across in the community scheme. But what is the issue here?
Chairperson, I do understand that it is inclusive. I think the point is, do you want to be taking up disputes with everybody or just the owner of that particular unit or section?
Madam Chair, in many community schemes, ownership is something which we understand in South African law as to be a certain thing. So for example, if you own a sectional type of unit, that's registered to the police office and you're the owner. But if you are in a shared block scheme, you don't own that property, you're the occupier of that property. And there's a range of community schemes which don't have ownership per se. And therefore, this doesn't only deal with the possibility of tenants, it deals with those people who have less than registered real rights.
Okay, cut off.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Executive committee means the executive body of a community scheme, including but not limited to the trustees of a sectional title body corporate, the board of directors of a share block company, and the management association of any housing scheme for retired persons. Thank you, Chair. Levies means the levies contemplated in section 59. Managing agent means any person who provides management services to a community scheme for reward.
Now they are saying they are going to align these definitions in line with the sectional title. So we have already have it in our possession.
this bill. So they could not change this without being in this gathering or meeting. Are you hearing now?
Thank you, Chair, for that clarity. I think procedure is that dictates to us to say that even though there are issues that, of course, are obvious that we need to insert, we cannot just take it for granted that, you know, the members will adopt, that the members need to agree so that we can change this particular. But for now that we are dealing with it now, when we reconvene for the next time, then we'll, of course, we can effect those particular changes as been agreed by the committee today. Umbot means an almost contemplated in section 21.3.
Oh, I think I need a more explanation on the occupier. Because here we are saying means a person who occupies a private area. They are still out of my. Because I think there will be a contradiction when we get to page 11. I don't know, let's get to page 11. So that we address this issue now. Page 11. Yeah, it's two, page 11. Two, one, Roman figure. B-E-2, and then subsection B. Oh, okay. Let's check the what is the heading? So four. Yes. Close four. Page five. And then under the function of service. It's 2B1. In performing its functions, the service may provide education, information, documentation, and such services as may be required to raise awareness to owners, occupiers, executive committee, and other persons and entities who have rights and obligations in community schemes as regards to those rights and obligations, and members of the public as regards the rights and obligations existing in community schemes. I need the explanation, because now there is an area where you are saying, maybe I'm missing, there is an area where you are saying an occupier occupies the area illegally. Not yet, but some as it goes on. So can we get the definition of the occupier? Because you may not occupy it illegally. You may occupy it legally because you have been given an obligation by the owner, whether you are a tenant or whatever. Can you define it clearly, this occupier? Professor?
Madam Chair, as I understand it, the definition of an occupier has to be read together with the definition of a private area, because that occupier is a person who occupies a private area. In practice, this would be something like a flat or a section in a sectional title scheme. It would normally be that the private area is where nobody else has rights to be. And that private area is defined just a few definitions further on. Yes, the private area is defined just one or two down as an area in a community scheme set aside for private occupation or ownership, excluding any common area. So what one is fundamentally doing here is saying that in every community scheme there are shared areas where people have a joint use rights, and you have exclusive areas, areas where only one person or one family is entitled to be. And one is drawing that distinction in terms of the legislation because it has to be dealt with later on. So the occupier is a person who is entitled to occupation of a private area. But there's no import in this particular legislation of any legality or illegality in that. I'm a little confused by your conclusion.
What do you think about this part? Okay.
Owner means a person who has a legally secured right to possession and occupation of a private area, including but not limited to the owner of a personal title unit, the holder of shares in a share block company, and the holder of an occupation right in a housing scheme for retired persons. Person includes an association, partnership, trust, corporation, private or public entity, and such person's representatives, successors, and assignees. Practice directive means a practice directive issued in terms of Section 36 of this Act. No, I was just emphasizing. My apologies, Chair. Private area means any area in a community scheme set aside for private occupation or ownership, excluding any common area. Prescribed means prescribed by regulation made under this Act. Public Finance Management Act means the Public Finance Management Act 99, Act number 1 of 1999. Regulation means a regulation made in terms of Section 29. Scheme governance documentation means any rules, regulations, articles, constitution, terms, conditions, or other provisions that control the administration or occupation of private areas and common areas in a community scheme. And scheme governance provision has a corresponding meaning.
There's a public opinion on that.
The comment is that minutes of trustee meetings, annual general meetings, and special general meetings held from time to time should be included in the definition, as they form an important aspect of with regards to the administration and finances, and are usually captured, and it's recommended that it should form part of this definition.
Madam Chair, the effect of extending that, just as background, every single community scheme has certain documents according to which it is established. Now, those are very different documents depending on what type of community scheme it is. But those are the documents which might, for example, be a constitution or the Sectional Titles Act and the rules made for that particular scheme. And they sit there as the founding, the governing documents. In the actual day-to-day operation of the community scheme, you're going to have things like minutes, and you're going to have all sorts of agendas and lots of other paperwork. That the minutes and the other sort of documentation referred to here is not something that the state has ever kept. The deeds registry don't keep, for example, minutes of meetings or things like that. They only keep the fundamental governance documentation. Of course, it could be done, but if it were done, that would have the effect of adding very considerably to the ombuds work. Now you are going to have to chase up and get hold of this documentation, which the minutes and that sort of thing, which that normally, the state wouldn't want to get involved in that normally. That is something that is internal housekeeping within the scheme. So one would normally allow people to look after their own fine detailed documentation, like minutes and agendas and that sort of thing. Where they are important, what we have provided at the end of this particular bill is a provision that the ombud, where he wants to, can call for certain information.
You mean the rules and regulations?
The
rules of action.
The rules would definitely be there for sectional title and any other that the minister decides, but not things like the minutes or the agendas. That wouldn't normally be collected.
So, okay, thanks.
Service means the community scheme combat service established by Section 3. This act includes the regulations. Agreed? Honourable members, we're in page 5, chapter 2. This is community schemes combat service. Clause number 2 deals with the purpose of act. Clause 2. The purpose of this act is to provide for A, the establishment of the service, B, the functions and operations of the service, and C, a dispute resolution mechanism in community schemes.
I think on B, why can't we add to say the functions, operations, and governance of the service? Because we do have the governance of the service. Why can't we add it?
And I know the people.
C.
The
dispute resolution mechanism in community schemes. So what are the sequence yet? We were also mentioning community schemes as well as sectional titles. I don't know why they decided to leave it here.
The definition of community schemes includes sectional title. So when you talk about community scheme, whenever you use that term, you're talking about sectional title, share block, all of the whole lot.
Clause 3, Honourable.
Can I just understand what was the comment about the including the governance?
Mm-hmm.
They agree. Oh, okay.
Clause 3, establishment of service. 3.1. There is hereby established a juristic person to be known as the community schemes ombud service. 2, the service operates as a national public entity listed in terms of the Public Finance Management Act with its executive authority vested in the minister. 3, the service must establish a national head office and, when necessary, regional offices. 4, the provisions of the Public Finance Management Act apply to the service. Four, functions of service. And the service must A, develop and provide a dispute resolution service in terms of this act. B, the service must provide training for adjudicators and other employees of the service. No. Yes, I have to receive.
And I'm asking, it's a question to you, to yourself. Why are we not deleting that control? Instead we say they regulate and monitor. You regulate and monitor the quality of all sectional title scheme governance. Yeah. But we start with regulate and then you monitor.
We accept it. The service must regulate, monitor, and control the
regulate and monitor
the quality of all sectional title schemes, governance, documentation, and such other schemes, governance, documentation, as may be determined by the minister by notice in the gazette. And D, take custody of, preserve and provide public access to sectional title and such other scheme governance documents as may be determined by the minister.
There's also been a suggestion in one of the submissions about the accessibility electronically to save on a large support staff. I don't know if you were able to look at that. You did? Ah, okay. And I'm just wondering, that, you know, relating to these, because obviously if there's a lot of hard copy documentation, it means that you've got a lot of support staff dealing with it. I think the suggestion is if it's electronic, it's easily accessible and it doesn't require the support staff. That's some
copy. What do we fit in here? C and D. What is the suggestion there?
From them is just, you know, I mean, can we look at it electronically or must it be hard copies that we're looking at?
To regulate and monitor the quality of all personal title schemes governance documentation and such other scheme governance documentation as may be determined by the minister by notice in the government gazette. But I wanted to check where do we fit in this?
Madam Chair, this is the documentation that is currently kept by the Deeds Registry that's been referred to here. It is received in hard copy, in paper format. It is digitized in most of the registries, but not all of them yet. Some of the smaller registries don't get digitized, but it certainly would make sense for the Ombuds Service to digitize the information and then to make it available in whatever format is required. If one looks at the Deeds Registry at the moment, most of the there is a small outflow in terms of faxed documents and electronically accessed documents, but the majority of documents are still accessed in terms of printed out physical hard copy. But with the greatest respect, Madam Chair, I don't think that the Act would be the place to tell the Ombuds exactly how to do that. What you're doing is placing an obligation on the Ombuds Service to make it available, and then perhaps allowing the Ombuds Service to do that in the most sensible way. The idea that it should be available electronically, I mean, a very small percentage of the people in South Africa have access to the World Wide Web and the Internet. So I think it might be misplaced to demand that the Ombuds do create an electronic access system immediately. This goes far enough, I suggest, Madam Chair.
I
don't think that if resources are available, I do think it should happen. And then I just guess that the Act anyway is giving an overall regulation, but at the same time allows the facility in terms of this operation. Because I don't think we can put everything that they're going to be doing in terms of daily operation of the Act and implementation of the Act. But just I do think, though, that the very same page. I think I agree with the regulation, monitoring and control. I think control in this context would be meaning that they are responsible to ensure that the section are titled key and that the quality is of great. Because some of them, anyway, they are very poor quality. But I think control in this context means that you take care, therefore it's adequate to ensure that the standard is an acceptable standard of that one. I think there will be no harm, Chair, if we allow, to regulate and monitor and control. Because control in this case really means that exactly, that they should, really, when we meet with them, they should also ensure that the standard of this section attacking is at the highest level, but also maintained. Therefore, they can take decisions around the very, very things that they do want to do so. I think in this case, really, I think we should try to keep it there.
I think we agree that you have to fit in the issue of the electronic one. We can work it around. It is very much important to be sure that it is there.
Thank you, Chair. Clause 4, subsection 2, in performing its functions, the service may A. promote good governance of community schemes.
Chairperson, I think, you know, we're dealing with here, can we not be looking at must? In performing its functions, the service must, and then promote those things.
No, me, Agafitisha does not fit me in this context. Or shall, instead of saying must, shall. They are going, Ushal means they are going to do this in performing. It's either we say my or must or shall. So can we agree on one thing, but may is not suitable here.
No, I was just saying that there's a point that you raised earlier on that they have added in terms of governance. And I think I would agree whether we use may or must or shall is fine for me. But we have raised it really that this and there is act anyway, the board and or the person must I think we're talking about governance that you included. And I think that governance to me applies will be consequential in all other clauses because the main article of the act we are saying that it must promote governance. I think it's something that must promote governance. And then I guess that it should be consequential really a must because you've already articulated it in the first instance that it must promote good governance. Generally, I don't think any harm really because there shouldn't be any board or any scheme that doesn't promote good governance. As a matter of must, really.
Number two, in performing its function, the service must A. promote good governance of community schemes. B. provide education, information, documentation, and such services as may be required to raise awareness. Two, owners, occupiers, executive committees, and other persons or entities who have rights and obligations in community schemes, as regards those rights and obligations, and members of the public as regards the rights and obligations existing in community schemes. Three, monitor community scheme governance, and generally deal with any such matters as may be necessary to give effect to the objectives of this act. Three, the service acts through its board.
May I raise one issue, Chair? That I'm again, there's no harm, really, the Roman figure 2. I think that it's a very nice, I think it's a really an ambitious problem. And then I guess what we're talking about should be awareness to owners, occupiers, all that one. But it seems now we are going further to say the members of the public. I think really we are setting ourselves up. Because that's really members of the public, we are talking about the entire society. If one person takes you to court, surely can call this law. That we are supposed to have educated the members, that is raise their awareness. Members of the society. I don't think it's correct in my view. I don't think it's necessary. Because what we are intending really, that those who got rights and obligations, and then we should raise the awareness in terms of the overall operation of the act. If really we go to soil and say that we'll run by meeting and then this is all, I don't think really will assist you. I think we'll set you at the rapture speaking. And also you need a lot of resources anyway to do so. Because I don't think we should put anything in any act that we know very well that would be very difficult to implement in terms of resources that are not there. Because if other people take you to court, I think we'll find it very difficult to justify. Of course, reasonably, there will be no money to do so. It is a very nice thing, but I don't think you want to put on the act anyway, because I think you are talking about the people who got legal obligation, all these private areas within the overall scheme, rather than the public as a whole. Members of the public, I think, too open for you. I guess we'll be opening ourselves up. But if there are resources to do so.
Paid by the department in the awareness of their program, because it's part of this program, it's part of the human settlement. So I don't think we can put it here. So I agree with you. But
thank you, Madam Chair. I think that because this is now a must, not a may, and it does have this effect. May I suggest that the one group of people who are not owners and occupiers who should be concentrated on is also the prospective purchasers of interests in community schemes. So if we take out the Roman 2, perhaps we could put into Roman 1, which will be incorporated into B, 2B, prospective purchasers or purchasers. Perspective, perhaps it's not the right word, but the intending purchases of just to widen that a little bit.
No, what we can do, all must are on above, we can shift them, and then we can say may or shall, because shall is not dangerous. So we can put at the end this Roman figure 2. You can see where we fit it in. We can change that. All the must, if C is must, it can go ahead. And then you bring it down. May I understand the question?
Yeah? Okay. Yes, I think we understand. I think the reason why, you know, the rationale behind for us actually including that Roman figure 2 was earlier, you know, we thought that is why in section 2 we're saying that those are some of the services that they may, you know, perform.
We
so
agree.
That's why we've included that particular part.
We agree. Don't have a problem in adding it, but we have to shift it downwards. And then you put me or shall, whatever. Yeah.
The exodus should be very specific. I think the way professor was phrasing it is far easier. Because it's not necessarily a public law, a public act for everyone. It's an act that is designed to assist the specific people. It's not about RTP or that. It's about specific people. And your act really should remain dealing with matters of specific group or category of people who are within the community service. So, because if you go broader than that, I think it would open yourself to a real problem. I thought because it's a specific act, it should remain a specific act. And therefore, but you can do whatever. I wouldn't have a problem, very happy anyway, seeing you in Alexander pacifizing the community. But I guess that you must was correct that if you are going to remove Roman Chica 1 and be very specific, who are the people that you want to raise the awareness about the existence of the scheme? I think those who have shown interest in buying to the scheme, they will be qualifying themselves for the real awareness. You have to raise it even before they commit themselves of what you want to do. I think that I can share with them.
The announcement of 5, the mandate. 5.1, the minister must conclude a written mandate with the service as soon as possible, but not later than 6 months after the appointment of the board. Okay. 5.2, the mandate must A, contain the operational and performance indicators against which the performance of the service is measured. B, the mandate must contain specific service delivery targets that the service must attain, and the mandate must contain directions regarding the utilization of any surplus revenue. 3, the mandate may deal with any other matter that the minister and the service may agree on. 4, the mandate must be reviewed every 5 years. 5, the mandate must be consistent with this act.
We're talking there, again, it's a question of must or may. In the first instance, we say the mandate may deal with any other matter that the minister and the service may agree on. I would imagine once the minister and the service has agreed on something, then they must do it. They mustn't be given an option. So the first may, I think, should be must. And then in subsection 4, the board members hold office for 3 years. And here we're talking about it must be reviewed every 5 years. I think that should be, because I would imagine when the board members change, it gives the minister an opportunity to review the mandate. So I think that it must be, or it may be reviewed every 3 years. It doesn't allow for a shorter period if we say it must be reviewed only every 5 years.
In terms of the demanding of institutions, a 3-year period is too short to measure the impact and also decide properly on what has to be changed in the mandate. Yes, I agree the board term of office is 3 years, but there is evaluation of the board almost annually, and after 3 years there is an evaluation of the board. But the mandate, this is consistent also with the Housing Development Act, that it should be 5 years. So I would propose that, Chair, in order to, you know, to properly evaluate the mandate, it should remain 5 years.
Yeah, Jake, can I just respond quickly? All I'm saying, I have no problem with the must 5 years, but I think we must give the option that when the board members change it, the minister may want to change the mandate. So perhaps if we say the mandate may be reviewed every 3 years, but must be reviewed at least every 5 years. So we're giving an opening that it could be done before 5 years, but it must at least be done every 5 years. Something to that effect.
think there's no harm on that one. So in the first one, O3 must, and then O3 we delete may. Then, listen to me, honorable. I'm saying section B, I mean 3, there's must, and then in section 4, it's may. And then the last one, the mandate must be consistent with this act. I don't know where does the other legislation fit, because whenever I was reading through this legislation, there's no mention of the housing policy legislations, because whatever schemes, though they are schemes, but I think that is a government, there are legislations that are governing the development of human settlements in South Africa. So generally, I was thinking, why are we not including other relevant legislation that governs the human relevant? Because we can't just do anything that is way out of the government policies or legislation. Professor, do you have something for Mr. Nkomiso?
There's no harm, Chair, in also consistent with the Act and other relevant legislation. There's no harm.
Can I come in regarding subsection 4 and the proposal that was made by Mr. Singh?
Okay.
It's paragraph. Yeah, it's subsection 4. And we're saying the mandate may be reviewed every 3 years, but must be reviewed every 5 years. I got that correct? Is that what you were saying? And I think this might create a confusion. I propose another alternative suggestion to say, because I hear what you want to achieve. You can say the mandate must be reviewed every 5 years or but for shorter period as the minister may determine. It must be 5 years or such shorter period to cover your 3 years. As the minister may determine. The minister may determine a shorter period. Yeah.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Clause number 6, Board of Service, 6.1, it is hereby established a board to be known as the Board of the Service. 2, the board is responsible for the management and control of the service.
Control now, this one is not. Yes, you govern.
Management and governance. We are now page 6, number 3. The board consists of A, 2 executive members, and B, 7 non-executive members. 4, the minister must appoint the chairperson and the deputy chairperson of the board from the non-executive members of the board. 5, the board may designate any other non-executive member of the board to act as a chairperson if both the chairperson and deputy chairperson are absent or unable to perform their functions. Agreed. Clause number 7, appointment of members of board. 7.1, the minister must by notice in the Gazette and two national newspapers circulating in the Republic invite all interested persons to submit within the period and in the manner mentioned in the notice the names of persons fit to be appointed as non-executive members of the board. Two, the minister must appoint a nomination committee to make recommendations to the minister for the appointment of the non-executive members of the board. Three, in establishing a nomination committee, the minister must ensure that the committee is broadly representative of the population and geographic areas of the Republic and that both males and females are represented.
Around the board members per se.
it is important that that one is highlighted, that it must be representative of the demographic and all those sort of things. I think it is important to that. So you have to separate. I think these are two issues, different issues. We have one, Mr. Commissioner. Who is that? Mr. Commissioner.
Chair, yes, I agree with you. With the nomination committee, it's normally a committee is going to sit, adjudicate, or rather evaluate the nominees and pick up a candidate to recommend to the minister. Obviously, if we need representation, as we did with other legislation, like Shra, for instance, we could have a provincial rep, we could have an MEC, we could have the parliamentary rep, which will sit in that committee to do that. As I think this is mixed up with the board.
I don't think it's mixed up, because when you read all these preceding paragraphs, they were talking about the nomination. But when you read the following, the next paragraph, they relate to the board itself in terms of how it should be constituted. When you read from 4 downwards, it talks about the
But this one is saying, in establishing a nomination committee, the minister must ensure. So that one relates to the nomination committee.
I agree, Chair. I agree. And I'm saying, in respect of the preceding, the foregoing paragraph, it relates to the nomination committee. And when you consider 4 downwards,
it says,
after you have established that nomination committee, this is how it should perform its work in terms of establishing the board.
Can we not talk about the new way in the country? Otherwise, we will be better. Can we not talk? I have a need, my teacher. Once the rest of our confused, all confused, it's going to be a problem. Can we not know you work out? New way in the country, Catholic.
Thank you, Chair. I think we'll provide more clarity.
I didn't get the question. Normally, it's three national papers of different languages. The driver here is the cost, and the main objective here is to cover everyone within the republic. That is why it says national, because a person could go for a regional, which will exclude other people.
But in terms of the delimitation of two, I think it's a cost driver. Otherwise, we'll publish that in all newspapers, which will not be cost effective. Non-executive members of the board. Seven, the minister must, within 30 days after such appointment, publish the names of the members so appointed and the date of commencement of their terms of office in the Gazette. Eight, the minister must, within 30 days after such appointment, publish the names of the members so appointed and the date of commencement of their terms of office in the Gazette.
Thank you, Chair. I raised the concern with 7.8 because we've had experience on other boards where terms ended simultaneously and then there was no transfer of knowledge and there was no continuity, and therefore we addressed this in the post-back bill, and I think that perhaps the State Board Advisor would like to just perhaps copy the idea as it's formulated in the post-back bill, which allows for a staggered appointment of first term at least.
Also, Chairperson, I'm not sure. Shouldn't we, under 7.4, come up now? with the stipulations of like the gender, the vulnerable, and things like that within this paragraph. Yes, because it directly deals with the actual board members. It's the appointment of members of the board, and then you've got seven.
Or the nomination committee in making a recommendation to the minister must consider or the those following. Okay,
yes.
All right. Do you have any problem to fit in that criteria of the demographics and what was here? I think it's suitable here because the state must look for the place that will be relevant. Where is it? Okay. Are you another board member? Can you see that?
Yes, I've noted the B section, mm-hmm. Need for historically disadvantaged persons. But it still doesn't address
the population, that part of the population. We agree that we're going to look at it. I think this is also suitable to you, that you don't remove anything you add.
Yes, thank you, Kevin.
No, I think that person, in my interpretation, I would have thought that 4B does cater for all the previous disadvantaged groups, whether it's women or by race, people by race.
Thank you, Chairperson. There's an assumption here that I'm not sure if we should just leave it as an assumption. And the assumption is this. We're talking about the minister putting together a nomination committee that will make recommendations of people that he must then appoint from. But it really just says, if we go on to the clause 6, it just says the minister appoints the non-executive members of the board. Now, we've gone through a process where the nomination committee is put together. We've indicated what they must take into consideration to make recommendations. But we're then really not saying, we're not actually saying the minister must then appoint the board from those recommendations. We're just assuming that that's what he'll do. But he may very well then appoint somebody that was not recommended. I just want clarity. Are we going to give that latitude, or are we going to actually say he must then appoint from those recommendations?
No, you can't advertise and then you appoint somebody from outside. But I think that maximum we've put there, it also allows the minister to appoint anyone else. Because this was saying we've got seven, then we're saying a maximum of 9 or 10. So we are giving the minister an opportunity to appoint it discretionary from outside. I think he can do that.
I don't think so, because there is 7 subsection 2. The minister must appoint a nomination committee to make recommendations to the minister for the appointment of non-executive members of the board. I think it's already covered there, that he will only appoint from the list that he will have got for the nomination committee.
It is covered, because even those people that he can appoint, they are also in that list of the interviewees.
Sorry, I didn't get that specific.
No,
why we are giving the maximum? You know, there are those candidates that come for interview. and then the committee will recommend a number as because here it's 7. So I think that 7, or we need to have a minimum number and then a maximum number. So that maximum number normally, it's normally 10. And then those members will appoint 8, and then we leave the 2. If the minister feels that, he can add that 2. It's not necessary to add the 2. He can leave it that space because the maximum, or he can appoint, but he's not going to appoint from that anyway, to look at the people. So all those people have been interviewed, but they were not recommended by the nomination committee to be on the first priority. But they are there. He's not going to pick up someone from outside. And it is recommended.
Chairperson Gujalo, in terms of procedure, he has to stick within the nominees, because we also have to inform the cabinet through a cabinet memo what procedure was followed.
I don't think we really need the subsection 6, because we have subsection 2 that was raised by the men. That already specified that the minister appoint the nomination committee to make recommendation to the minister for the appointment of planning committee members.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that presentation. Are you saying, sorry, Chairperson, is she suggesting that we delete subsection 6?
Because it's covered
in subsection 2. Okay, thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's it. Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. A non-executive member of the board, A, holds office for a period not exceeding 3 years and may be reappointed on expiry of his or her term. B, may not serve for more than 2 consecutive terms of office. C, non-executive member of the board is appointed according to the terms and conditions determined by the minister. D, must be paid from the revenue of the service such remuneration and allowances as may be determined by the minister in consultation with the Minister of Finance, taking into consideration regulations and guidelines issued by the Minister of Public Service and Administration and the National Treasurer.
Because the board, I think, is the national guidelines, the national treasury guidelines, as well as in, public service, it is about the board.
Chair, the guidelines are joint guidelines developed by the Public Service Administration and Treasury. So we can choose to elevate National Treasury and leave out public service, but all remunerations in public, in any institutions, are governed by the recommendations of the Public Service and Administration to the National Treasury.
Nine, any vacancy occurring in the board must be filled in the same manner as a member is appointed in terms of this section.
Chair, on that note, you know, this section only deals with non-executive members, and I just thought that there we may be better placed to set something to be set as the vacating member was appointed, instead of in terms of the section. So it also covers a non-executive member. Sorry, an executive member.
Clause 8, functions of board. 8, the board must A, implement the mandate contemplated in section 5 and any strategic plan of the service in order to achieve the objectives of the service. B, make decisions on behalf of the service and ensure that these decisions are carried out. C, provide guidance to the chief ombuds in the performance of his or her functions in terms of this act.
Chairperson, the organization itself develop the plan and present the plan to the minister for approval. Okay, we will attend to that.
Notify the minister immediately of any matter that may prevent or materially affect the achievement of the objects or financial targets of the service, and E, refer to the minister any matter concerning the adverse functioning of the service.
Yes, yeah, and my question is here. Who appoints the chief ombudsman? Candidate ombudsman. Because here we refer to the minister appoints the non-executive. Who appoints the executive? In terms of the functions of the board, it's not there.
Nine, disqualification from membership of board. Nine, a person may not be appointed as or remain as a member of the board, as the case may be, if that person A, is an unrehabilitated insolvent or becomes insolvent, and the insolvency results in the sequestration of that person's estate. B, has been declared by a competent court to be mentally ill. C, has been convicted in the Republic or elsewhere of theft, fraud, forgery, perjury, and any other offense involving dishonesty. D, has been convicted of any other offense, whether in the Republic or elsewhere, committed after the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa, 1993, took effect, and sentenced to imprisonment without the option of a fine. E, has been or is removed from an office of trust on account of misconduct in respect of fraud or the misappropriation of money. F, is otherwise disqualified from serving as a member of a board in terms of the Companies Act, 2008 Act Number 71 of 2008, or has or acquired an interest in a business or enterprise which may conflict or interfere with the proper performance of his or her functions as a member of the board. Number 10, plus 10, resignation and removal from office.
May I indulge by, can I take advantage of this opportunity? Because I'm not going to pay for this legal opinion. I'm just utilizing the expertise of our legal leaders. Why is it necessary to state that it is one of the criteria that applies is that an unrehabilitated insolvent, like something that affects or that is of section 9 subsection B, A. Why is it important to utilize that? Because if you are insolvent, it doesn't mean that you're brain dead, you cannot function. What has insolvency got to do with being a board member? Legal opinion, Chairperson.
I'm afraid this isn't, Chair, going to be a deep legal opinion because it's not researched, but in essence, the disadvantage that one would have dealing with an unrehabilitated insolvent is that person does not have full contractual capacity, doesn't in law have the same right to enter into agreements, and also, whilst unrehabilitated, is not the master of the estate which they had before they became insolvent. The other thing that must be said is that somebody who is insolvent or an unrehabilitated insolvent has no money. They therefore, with respect, probably have less. They are somebody who has mismanaged an estate. And for that reason, there must be a society looks at such a person and says, no, you should not be in a position of trust because you have mismanaged your own affairs.
Chair, it's part also of the Treasury guidelines with regard to the appointment of board members.
Thank you, Chair.
Expected to compromise the board in the performance of its function.
Thank you, Chair. There's a qualifier at the end of that sentence which says, which could reasonably be expected to compromise the board in the performance of its functions. And my thinking was that any direct or indirect interest in community schemes should be disclosed, and because that person may not always be the best judge of whether it's going to, at any stage in the future, create an interest, a conflict of interest. And then I think in addition, it would be instructive to also include that the person discloses all financial interests just as a matter of record for any future references. They got me on that. That's the first point I mentioned. Okay.
No, I'm not sure. A member of the board may not be present or taking part in the discussion or the taking of a decision on any matter before the board in which that member or his or her family member, business partner or associate has a direct or indirect financial interest. Thank you, Madam Chair. Two, a member of the board may not be present. If a member of the board acquires an interest that could reasonably be expected to be an interest contemplated in this section, he or she may immediately in writing declare that fact to the minister and the board.
Thank you. The answer is to just put the exact reference such as sub clause 1 and 2.
Okay.
Then instead of in the section. Then also at clause 3, after the word immediately my view was a little bit vague, and I think there we should put a cut of time. So I'm proposing that after immediately to include the phrase, but no later than X months. So the committee just has to fill in X there, whether it's
okay.
X months or whatever time the committee feels appropriate.
Okay.
It's not an amendment to this particular clause, but my question really is, what then? We say they must declare to the minister. So now, fine, I've declared I've got an interest. But what then? What happens after you've declared? Is it fine you can carry on? Or does it default to one of the others where it says if you've got an interest? It's a bit vague. What happens then?
Yes, Chairperson, if you remember correctly, I also further on propose an additional clause 11.8, which criminalizes subsections 1 to 3.
Okay.
Thank you. Yes, thank you, Chair. My concern there was twofold. One was that the heading of this clause of the fiduciary duty and disclosure. So one presupposes that we're talking about the fiduciary duty and disclosure of board members. But now you're placing an obligation in this provision on an outside entity to disclose to the board, to the to who is it now, to the minister or whoever, that a member has an interest in that entity. Now, I don't know of what value that would be. It's the member's question, if not, then what? I think this is misplaced under the heading, fiduciary duties and disclosure, firstly. And secondly, I think that this is one of the clauses, wherever it is now placed, should have some repercussions. It should either be criminal liability, but otherwise it's of very little value to have a clause like this without a consequence.
Chair, I believe that everything that's been said is exactly correct. The first question that has to be asked is this necessary? If it is, if because it does, I mean, this entire bill is about controlling the ombuds and the ombuds service, and the point has been well made that this particular provision seeks to it throws its net as wide as the whole of South Africa. Anybody is now placed under an obligation. So the first question is, do you want it at all? If you do want it, then I think that's quite right. We've got to make it a sub, another sub, and then criminalise it at the end.
I think in week we are supposed to break at 12:30 because there is a memorial service of one of the honourable members. So we were going to take up to quarter to at least 15 minutes, and we can sacrifice 15 minutes. So let's just carry on for this remaining 15 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A member of the board must at all times exercise the utmost good faith, honesty and integrity, care and diligence in performing his or her functions as a member of the board, and in furtherance of these functions and without limiting their scope, must A, take reasonable steps to inform himself or herself about the service, his business, and activities and the circumstances in which it operates. Page 8. B. Take reasonable steps through the processes of the board to obtain sufficient information and advice about all matters, you know, to be decided by the board, to enable him or herself to make conscientious and informed decisions. C. Attend all meetings of the board. D. Exercise an active and independent opinion with respect to all matters to be decided by the board. D. Exercise an active and independent opinion with respect to all matters to be decided by the board. E. Exercise due diligence in relation to any business of and necessary preparations for an attendance at meetings of the board or any committee to which such a member of the board is appointed. F. Comply with all internal code of conduct that the service may establish for members of the board. G. Not engage in any activity that may undermine the integrity of the service. H. Not make improper use of his or her position as a member or of information acquired by virtue of his or her position as a member of the board, and I treat any confidential matters relating to the service that is of t- retained in his or her capacity as a member of the board as strictly confidential and not divulge them to anyone without the authority of the service or as required as part of that member's official functions as a member of the board. 6. This section must be interpreted as adding to and not deviating from any law relating to the criminal or civil liability of a member of a governing body and criminal or civil proceedings that may be instituted in respect of such a liability. 7. A member who contravenes or fails to comply with this section may be charged with misconduct.
I just want to take us back to 5C. We're actually saying in this piece of legislation that a member of the board must attend all meetings of the board. We will recall from recent presentations of entities that in some cases they are actually very poor attendants, and in some cases there are very specific reasons for non-attendance. So I'm not sure if we can actually put it there that they must look, they expected to. But the way we put it here, we say they must attend all meetings of the board when we know it's not always possible. So if that could be, from a legal point of view, adjusted. So the expectation is there, but they may not.
You put an apology. So must be fine. Because you have to, you are obligated to do it. But for certain reasons, you won't be able to do it. But if you have not been able to do it, you know what are the procedures. Instead, those procedures are going to be there, the rules, whatever, within regulation. But normally, must, I don't think you can take it out, must. Because even the minister has got the right to say, to look at your attendance performance. And then can even say, if you are not attending for so many meetings, start to work. Mamo Honorable, Jolie?
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. I agree. But then sometimes there's a provision in the legislation which then says, if the member has been absent for so many times without an apology, then that member is disqualified. In which case, if it's agreed, that should be provided for under Section 9.
I'm just raising this one from you, from the that their board issue declaration. I just guess that is in line with all existing laws of the country, because this is not the first board, and I think it's in line with many other boards. But I guess that there will be no contradiction from what you are putting in and what is existing of the law of the country in terms of declaration, in terms of qualification to be a member, or in terms of when you get disqualified. And of course, it may be discriminatory here and there if you are who are vested, but I think those are laws of the country that we must also. I guess that is in line, really. There's no contradiction here that we are opening ourselves up for many interpretations. Okay, not fine.
Okay, Honorable Chair, let me quick. Committees, that is number 12. The board may establish one or more committees to perform such functions as the board may determine. 2. The board must A. assign members of the board to serve on a committee. B. based on their knowledge and skills, and B, determine the number one, terms of reference of a committee, number two, composition of a committee, three, tenure of members of a committee, four, reporting mechanism of a committee, and five, methods and reasons for removal of a member from a committee. Subsection three, non-executive members of the board must make up the majority of the members of the committee. Four, the board may appoint specialists to a committee for their technical support. Five, unless specially delegated by the board, the committee has no decision-making power and can only make recommendations to the board. Six, a committee must meet as often as is necessary in order to carry out its functions and may determine its own procedures. Seven, each committee must be chaired by a non-executive member of the board. Delegation and assignment of functions by board. 13.1, the board may, by a resolution passed by 75% of its members, A, delegate any of its powers and assign any of its functions to, 1, any member of the board, any committee established in terms of section 12, 3, the chief ombud, 4, the chief financial officer, or 5, any employee of the service, and B, amend or revoke such delegation or assignment. 2, notwithstanding a delegation or assignment contemplated in subsection 1, the board is not divested of any power or duty so delegated or assigned. 3A, any delegation or assignment contemplated in subsection 1 may be made subject to such conditions as the board may determine, and 2, must be communicated to the delegee and assignee in writing. B, the written communication contemplated in paragraph A, figure 2, must contain full particulars of the matters being delegated or assigned and of the conditions subject to which the powers may be exercised or the function must be performed. 4, the board may not delegate A, the power to appoint the chief ombud, and B, its role on the appointment of the chief financial officer, number 2, the implementation of the mandate, and 3, the implementation of any strategic plan of the service.
Thank you very much. I think we can stop here for today.
May I see, just make a request again? I know that it's very difficult for drafters always to be as simple as they could. But again, simple, straightforward language in that discussion. I don't even know what is divested. Because I'm just trying our level. But as difficult as it is, your nice legal jargon is fine for you because you understand interpretation. But a person like me, very difficult.